think a lot of, interestingly enough, a lot of what we think of as productivity tools are distractions, or what I think of as creative nuisances. Or not creative. What is it when you have a swimming pool that offends attractive nuisances? Not that they're
a
not
a swimming
good.
Pool is an attractive nuisance?
A swimming pool that offends legally is considered an attractive nuisance because children will come and jump in and drown. So a lot of this stuff
seems like a good idea.
As good as it is, a lot of it's an attractive nuisance if it's not delivering business productivity, the ivity of product. Do I produce? Is the entire production system, by i.e. a software development team and its support organization, do they produce? Mm. And it's not about how can I use ReSharper to make code faster.
Right.
If getting that code faster doesn't get the product built faster.
It starts making them feel guilty.
And that's all about eliminating rework, closing the gaps in communication and handoffs. And it has nothing to do with development tools or data binding for that matter.
Which gets us into
the fastest amount of developer productivity that I can do so that I can create a giant backlog in front of QA is not productivity.
No, you're right. I think you're right. Because productivity to one programmer in a simple-minded way would be lots of lines of code in a minimal number of hours.
Sure.
But that
code
why are we
generation.
Writing code? We are writing it for business, for a purpose.
So when we have this decontextualized productivity, I think we end up with conferences that talk about technologies that are supposed to deliver productivity that maybe not consciously people are thinking about it, but subconsciously and experientially people go, you know, I don't actually get a lot of productivity out of any of these technologies. It's still a pain in the ass. It's still hard. So, I mean, are we breeding cynicism by continuing to talk about developer productivity when we're not talking about productivity?
Well, see, some people say, like, ReSharper makes me really productive, and I just feel like that's just code generation. It's just macro.
It does to a sense, but it's not like, I mean, not to sound like an old guy, but, you know, there was a time we did test-driven development without ReSharper, and it went just fine.
The fact that we now have
entire forks of ASP MVC so that we can have strong typing, so that we can use ReSharper to rename symbols. And now we've started to call symbols in text magic strings. They're not actually magic strings. Magic strings is a word. It means something.
Well,
now,
anything
that's text that's an identifier is called a magic string.
Well, the whole strong typing thing is, I mentioned this in my talk earlier, is the idea that the compilation step is just the first unit test. And the idea that, I got IntelliSense, I have strong typing, that's all just a myth.
So how many millions of Ruby and Python developers... how many millions of Ruby and Python developers do we need to contradict .NET developers' notions of what developer productivity is?
Well, really quickly, productivity, though, what I wanted to say a second ago is that we want to be careful about ever optimizing for one particular aspect of productivity.
Absolutely.
I think you're saying something similar.
I'm saying, optimize the whole.
I don't even think optimize the whole. Optimize appropriately. Right, a quick and dirty little tool that needs to get busted out today that's going to get used 25 times over the course of the next month and then never again. Damn straight, data binding, WinForms, ship that sucker, I'm not going near it again, done, thank you.
But how often does that happen that you
actually
don't
in actual business all day long?
It happens all day long, but I think Michael's point is that how often does it happen that after a month goes by, then they need to add another month, and then maybe they add a month after that, and then maybe suddenly it's 3 years later.
But then you're talking about optimizing for what could happen.
I agree. I'm never going to optimize for what could happen, but it's an interesting problem to think about. That I think you make the right optimization when you think it's only for a month. That's correct. Mm. But then as you approach later on, you have to somehow convince the business that we have to make a different kind of investment to get a different kind of an optimization. I wrote a little tool for the oil company that my dad worked for when I was in college, a little C application on a VMS machine. And it translated a nasty, gigantic, three-dimensional oil data log file from one format to another. I discovered 7 years later, I wrote it for him to use on a weekend. Mm-hmm. 7 years later, they're still using it inside that company.
Well, good thing that you didn't have to debug it at all. It still works.
They had ported it from that VMS machine to four other platforms, including Windows. It was a piece of crap I wrote as a college student. This is Michael's
you
were talking
about those things.
But it wasn't something you had to change then.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like the thing is...
That's a transformation tool. That's a utility. That's no big deal.
I'm just pointing out that you want to optimize correctly, but the problem with optimizing correctly is that you can optimize against what you know, and you can optimize against what you might predict. And when you optimize too much about prediction, you're going to get it wrong.
Isn't that all just Yagni, right? You're not going to need it, so you worry about refactoring it later.
That wasn't the point that I was making.
This code that basically people thought would never have to be changed severely, and it does.
Yeah.
And we don't really seem to think enough about how can we make the change cases easier for our code, not just as we do it as developers a bit, but tool developers really don't think about the changeability of solutions that they produce. And it's really a key thing because, you know, you can be the victim of your own success, and you discover later on, it's like, I'm wildly successful, I just can't modify the code anymore. That's tough.
Well, how many applications right? How many projects have you been on that started out the conversation, you know, you're brought in, and the conversation starts out, well, we have this access database, ... And what happened here was somebody produced a solution that solved the problem in a very limited context, and then the context changed, right? And now all of a sudden we have to try to refactor the technology to meet that changing context, which means now we've got to draw on new tools. And so then people take that and go beyond and say, well, okay, yesterday two people used it, today we think 10 people will use it, but because we don't want to do this a third time, assume that a million people will use it, architecture appropriately.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be these things, but the question is really, can we design technology which is malleable enough to make the change cases that we don't anticipate easier?
Right.
And that's the hard
thing.
And that's just,
oh, well, that's just good design.
It is, I guess, but it's like I keep looking for more than that. I keep looking for, what can we do, I mean, particularly people making tools, can you make things so that if you do generate code that it is easy to modify and regenerate if you need to? I mean, stuff like that, it's, you know.
But to a certain degree, Scott's right? You get down that path too far, and all of a sudden you say, oh, yeah, now all of a sudden you're designing for things that you, in fact, will never need, may never need. You're trying to predict via crystal ball, right? And it's weird because this is one of those spaces where if you go too much this way or you go too much that way, either way, you're wrong.
I'll tell you what, though. There's an idea a friend of mine threw around a long time ago, and it's kind of like a notion that's saying, well, you know, every method should be enforced by language to have no more than 50 tokens in it. Right? I mean, think about that. I mean, we always talk about it as a matter of good practice, going and saying, okay, let's have really short methods.
Well, this isn't all success based on some artificial constraint. Like, let's just say 140 characters, that'll be enough. Hey,
yeah,
wildly
yeah.
successful.
But it's an
50
you know,
tokens, you pull it
you
right out of your butt.
You have to get people to voluntarily submit themselves to that constraint by using the technology. But the thing is, it's like I spend so much time dealing with, in archaic technologies, trying to break down big methods where you don't have refactoring tools. And it's an ungodly mess. It's just, it's a thing that we can solve. We just have to go and basically try to figure out whether we can do it at a tool level or just at a practice level. Yeah.
Or both. Yeah, in some cases, I think what we have seen over the years is what started out as practice eventually gets codified by tool, right? And then in some cases, what happens is codification by tool turns into dogmatic enforcement, turns into we lost sight of why we did this in the first place.
Well, here's a story. I spoke to a team once, and I said, well, you know, it's great to go and keep these things rather short. And I told them about my friend's idea, and they said, oh, yeah, our managers have already told us we cannot have methods more than this number of lines. And they actually program this way. And you look at their code, and you realize that this is exactly what you would expect to have happen. You say, you know, A calls B, C, D, and then calls something else, which goes and calls C, D, F, and you end up having this crazy chain of calls.
And the method names are actually B, C, D.
Yeah, but honestly, untangling large methods is so damn painful. I prefer that code. You know, when you think
I don't know. I've seen a code base where, you know, everything was basically one large method. And during a code review, we told the guy, okay, no, you need to break this up into smaller bits. And so literally, he did. Method part one,
step one
which
step
at the very
two.
Last,
I've
called method part two,
step
which
step one,
at the very
open
last,
parent, step two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I still believe that.
Let's make all those variables
the
global.
The thing is
exactly.
At the beginning, when you find the pile of shit that has 1,000 lines.
Don't swear. I want a video.
Bleep. He's already beat me to it a whole bunch of times. You didn't hear what he said in French. You can't publish that.
I have to publish this.
When you've got a 1,000-line method, and you break it up into method one, method two, method three, method four, method five, just arbitrarily, I do think that's better, but I think ultimately it's step one of nine, right? Because it helps you find the functional blocks, because as you realize the things you have to pass into one and then get out, you realize, a little bit of rework here, and boom, I can turn that into a method that is cohesive.
Big promise.
But by trying in the first place,
but,
it's something
you know,
Ward Cunningham
taught. So often I find myself doing extract method, and then I just feel dirty, because I know I've buried something.
Well, see, Ward taught me this really cool trick of to use extract method as a way of visualizing the entry points and exit points of an arbitrary block of code, and then pressing cancel. Right? He would come up behind me, and he'd say, select all that and say extract method, and I'd select it all, and he'd say, see, look, why is that thing taking, why is that little block of code, of four lines of code,
doesn't
taking,
that mean you should be writing in a functional
parameters
language,
in and two
though?
Parameters out. Why is it doing that?
Doesn't this ultimately mean you should be writing in a functional language?
I don't know if it's saying you should be writing in a functional
language.
What you've
just described is, gosh, I really should be writing in a functional language.
Well, you know,
but that's just saying that the language should enforce this kind of behavior, and I think Ward was saying you can learn something about your code by just letting a tool like a refactoring tool designed for function X
You're just saying
something.
That you needed a visualizer that would tell you the explicit and implicit parameters
ins and
into this
of an
ins and out
block
of an arbitrary block code.
Within
so that's
an
interesting tool right there.
No, we already have it.
Well, yeah, ReSharper already does that.
If you call extract method, I'm talking about something that does it all the time in the background implicitly.
Why?
You know, but honestly, you know,
why not?
It only takes me a quarter of a second to ask the question. I don't need that.
Well, you know, the thing is, pick your technology. You don't have that in Ruby. You don't have it in C++, right? A lot of these things are really tooling issues that we're doing they want to impose, you know, to solve problems at a language level.
I will admit I'm startled that none of this stuff.
But I'm pointing out
well,
to
I
hang up.
Yeah.
JetBrains has a tool that does this stuff. I mean, especially just simple renames and simple extract methods.
Very
the stuff they use, yeah. The stuff that you use most, the 80%. The other refactoring stuff doesn't work, of course, because metaprogramming. But it's there. No one's actually using it in the Ruby community, though.
Well, they're all using TextMate, and they're proud of TextMate. It's a hideous retro-futurism thing.
It's a I'm going to close. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
But isn't this like people who write C code in VI? It's just they're doing it because it's hard.
No, you have to write C code in VI. You can't write it in any other.
I use VI
in Ruby and anything other than TextMate.
Ah, I disagree.
It's just a given.
Right. So I think it's interesting we started the conversation talking about what is productivity compared to, you know, the .NET mainstream. It's data binding and drag and drop, and got into what I think is what really comes down to the big productivity issues. It's never the problem's never data binding. It's friggin' maintenance. It's rework. Friggin' maintenance.
Friggin' maintenance.
Thank you for saying
that. Is that a French word?
No, it's friggin.com. It's a new company.
Friggin.
I have to do software.
All right, this is degrading. Another good time to stop. See you later.